This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Andrew Sullivan, resigned from his position as editor of The New Republic last year at about the same time that he publicly revealed he was HIV positive. He had been the youngest editor of The New Republic, taking over at the age of 28 in 1991, and he was the first openly gay editor of a national magazine that wasn't part of the gay press. Sullivan has edited a new book called Same-Sex Marriage, Pro and Con. It's a collection of writings on the subject, beginning with Plato and the Bible, and including such contemporary thinkers as William Bennett and Congressman Barney Frank. There are chapters devoted to the religious and legal controversies surrounding gay marriage, as well as to the debates on the left and the right. Many heterosexual couples today are living together, even having children, without getting married. I asked Andrew Sullivan if he thinks marriage is still as important as it once was.
Well, I think the issue really is not about whether people want to. It's a question about whether they have the right to choose it. The position of gay men and lesbians is really unique in the society. The interesting choice to have an alternative lifestyle is not actually available. It's compulsory for a section of the society. And I think trying to get people to understand that is very hard, even to get gay people to understand that.
Well, let's look at some of the pieces that you've collected in your book, Same-Sex Marriage, and go all the way back to Plato.
Yes.
You reprint something from Plato's Symposium. What is the larger work that this is from?
This is from the Symposium, a dialogue by Plato about love. And it's interesting that Plato and the Greeks, of course, understood love to exist in three different ways: heterosexual love, lesbian love, and homosexual male love. And they didn't really draw any profound distinctions between them. And they saw the essential need for one human being to join with another human being to be completely whole. And they saw that as an essentially human experience. Now, Plato, in its Aristophanes speech, actually doesn't mention marriage in this context. And that's largely because in those days, women were regarded as so inferior that they didn't understand heterosexual marriage to be as important as I think it is. But they did understand way back then that the instinct for marriage is, at its root, love, and this strange and mysterious notion that we are not complete until we meet the other person who completes us. And I thought that it was important to just start this whole discussion with that very basic human understanding, because I think heterosexuals understand that and know that. And once they meet or understand a gay person, I think it's clearer to them why this might be something that gay people would naturally want.
So you included this because of Plato's understanding that they were different kinds of love, and those kinds of love included the love of one person for another person of the same gender.
Yes. I mean, people talk about the issue of homosexuality as if it's something, you know, that started in 1969, you know, with Stonewall. The problem of how to fit gay people into a society has existed in every culture, at every time, at every moment in history. And one of the things I try and do here, for example, is point out how in 17th century China, there were clear references to same-sex marriages between one man and another in a small province called Fujian, which was kind of like the San Francisco of the time. Or even in northern Africa, there were tribes where women, powerful women who were infertile, would marry another woman and then have children through a third party, a man who would have no rights over that child. And the marriage ceremony between the two women would be identical to that between a man and a woman. But this is an ancient question. It's not something that's emerged recently.
You, of course, go back to the Bible and quote some passages from there in your reader, and you quote from Leviticus, "If a man also lie with mankind as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination, they shall surely be put to death."
Yes.
As a Catholic, what do you make of that?
It's difficult, and I don't want to elide the point that the Catholic Church does teach that any sexual relation between two men or between two women is morally wrong. They don't argue, as Leviticus does, that they should be put to death. And part of the argument in the book that I try and tease out of the Church and through their own documents and some critiques of them is, what is the origin of that? And for the Catholic Church, it is because it's not procreative, and that the only sex that's legitimate is within marriage, that is procreative and unitive in an emotional bond. And I might understand that, except that they do allow marriages which are not procreative to take place for the infertile or for people who are too old to bear children, because they understand that these people cannot change that particular fact of their identity. And the church also concedes that gay people cannot change that particular part of that identity. So it seems to me to be up to the church now to say why some kinds of non-procreative sex are legitimate and can be blessed, and others cannot.
Another way of putting that is what you write in the book. You say, if procreation is essential to marriage, then why doesn't Pat Buchanan have any children?
Yes, or for that matter, Bob Dole and Elizabeth Dole, Newt and Marianne Gingrich.
So what's your larger point there?
My larger point is that we have already, as a society, conceded that marriage today is between two equal people, that children are not intrinsically necessary for it, and that on the current qualifications, not changing it at all, there is no rational justification for excluding 3% of the population. Because we're prepared to, as gay people, to abide by any of the other rules. And does it make any sense that a gay couple that lived together for 40 years, cared for each other, maybe nursed each other through AIDS, or maybe have had children, or committed themselves in that way, have no legal rights at all, and yet two strangers who are heterosexual on the street can meet and 10 minutes later walk into a registry office and have all the constitutional rights of a married couple? Most people, I think, when they think about it, realize that's a crazy injustice. And the other thing that sort of one thinks of in that respect is, and I went back to look at all the constitutional precedents for the right to marry. This is not like the right to watch cable television or the right to shop on Sundays. Loving versus Virginia, the U.S. Supreme Court says this: the freedom to marry has long been recognized as one of the vital personal rights essential to the orderly pursuit of happiness by free men. Could any heterosexual who's listening to this program conceive that the right to pursue happiness, their right to pursue happiness in the Declaration of Independence, could not include the right to marry the person they love?
Let's look at the debate in the courts. There were two big, seemingly contradictory decisions last year. Hawaii granted the right to marry two gay couples, mm-hmm. the first state to do that. But there was the Defense of Marriage Act, passed federally, that makes gay marriage illegal on the federal level. Mm-hmm. How can those two things exist at the same time?
Well, they don't yet, because the state Supreme Court in Hawaii has yet to finally rule. The trial court, the lower court, already ruled in favor. It's now being remanded, and we will have a final decision probably by the end of this year. Well, we've never had a situation, however, in American history where the federal government has stated that marriage is one thing, and the states, or any single state, has stated that it's another. This is the Defense of Marriage Act was the first time in history that the federal government had defined marriage. During the whole miscegenation precedents, when the country was going through the turmoil of the Civil War even, and when interracial marriage was the critical issue, the federal government never felt the need to define it one way or the other. It said it's always a state's issue. So what you're going to have, I think, if and when Hawaii rules finally that this is going to happen, is an unprecedented battle between the states, among the states, and between the states and the federal government about what marriage is. Because you're going to have a situation where a couple, a legally married couple in Hawaii, are married in Hawaii, and they go to the rest of America, and they're not married. Their children are legitimate, and they go on vacation, and they're illegitimate. And I think that is going to become clearer and clearer as intolerable. You can't, with something as basic as your marital status, you can't go from one state to another across the country and suddenly be married and unmarried and married and unmarried. The legal and let alone psychological consequences of that are really horrifying.
You're Catholic. You're staying in the church in spite of the fact that the church does not recognize same-sex marriage and mm-hmm. is kind of uncomfortable with the idea of homosexuality in general, I think it's fair to say. Mm-hmm. Why do you stay?
Because it's my faith. Because I believe fundamentally that the vast majority of its teachings are true. And because it's my church. And even though I can see that it is excluding me, I've tried to engage its doctrines to point out that I don't think actually it's preaching hatred. I think it's preaching just a contradiction that it hasn't yet resolved. And this is an ancient institution that I believe is trying to support one of the truest things about human love in the world. And it takes time to change. And I won't let them take that away from me. I won't let them take my own faith away from me in terms of bearing witness to what I believe in. I mean, it's partly because as a Catholic, I do believe in the individual integrity of human love that I've come to these conclusions. I haven't decided to be openly gay or to fight this battle because I'm in rebellion, but because I think I'm trying to be in obedience to what the Church ultimately teaches, which is that human beings are born equal in the eyes of God, and that the right to love someone is so profound and important from a Christian point of view to a person's fulfillment that to arbitrarily to deny a group, a part of humanity, that fundamental goal in their lives is against the Gospels. It is deeply against the Gospels, and I cannot but believe that the Church will eventually recognize that, and I'm trying to bear witness to that in good conscience.
Andrew Sullivan is my guest, and he's edited a new book called Same-Sex Marriage, Pro and Con, A Reader. He's also the former editor of The New Republic. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Andrew Sullivan, former editor of The New Republic, and editor of the new book, Same-Sex Marriage, Pro and Con, A Reader. Do you hope to get married someday?
I guess somewhere in the back of my mind, yes. But I'm single. and I guess my life so far, my career, has just rather put these things on the back burner. I'm trying to put them more on the front burner. But like anybody, you know, I'm subject to the whims of meeting the right person and at the right time in the right way. And so far, it hasn't worked out. But yes, no, I hope so, eventually.
It's the kind of modern dilemma, too busy writing that book on same-sex marriage to actually have a relationship.
It's funny, so many of us, actually, I was saying this the other day, who are more activists in the marriage movement, all of us are single. we don't have time to meet the person we love. We just want the right to have it. But anyway.
If you were married, what would you want from it that you feel you can't get just from a deeply committed relationship?
Oh, I think the sense of one being completed in one's own family, to be really a part of the place that is your home. I think many of us, because of our homosexuality, are really excluded from our own homes in some very basic ways. And we watch our brothers and sisters get married and have children or be recognized and have the whole family come around to them and see that passing on through the generations. And it's never there for us. And that's a deeply wounding and isolating experience. And so I think it's really the ancient desire to come home and to have that recognized, and also even within our own churches, to come home there too. And of course, politically, within the culture at large, to have our loves recognized as they truly are. I mean, it's a very basic human need to have one's life and love acknowledged.
A lot of gay people have had wedding ceremonies, even though their marriage isn't considered legal.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you've been to a lot of gay weddings and if you have any observations to share about the different ceremonies that you've witnessed.
They're extraordinarily various. Some of them are very traditional. Some of them are completely contemporaneous. One of the astonishing things I've noticed is the heterosexuals at those things are often more at ease than the homosexuals. They almost know this ritual. They know what to do. I've listened to fathers stand up and talk about their sons or daughters. I've listened to brothers and sisters stand up and talk about their brothers and sisters. And to hear that said about a homosexual is a very deeply healing experience. The last one I went to was between two men who were 31 and 33, one of whom was an old college friend of mine, knowing that they would probably die within the next 2 or 3 years. And in fact, one of them has died subsequently. And when they said, for better or worse, in sickness and in health, they meant it. And to celebrate that union on the edge of that possible oblivion was particularly moving to me. And I think you cannot understand this impulse for love and marriage without understanding also the profoundly humanizing and spiritual experience that the AIDS epidemic has brought about. When you've watched someone you love die, when you've experienced that on such a large scale, you realize that the ability to take the time to commit to someone and the time spent in the love and a marriage relationship is so important. It's the most important thing in the world. And to celebrate that almost as you're about to go under is about as deep a commitment as you can find. It's rather like those marriage ceremonies in death camps. I think that has been the emotional motor behind this movement. That and, ironically, birth. I think that the deaths of gay men and the births that many lesbian women have had recently with children, they have also realized in this baby boom that's going on among lesbians that their children are vulnerable and they don't actually have access to them or a right to them.
Well, it's interesting that you think that the AIDS epidemic has led to a new spirituality among gay people, because it could have worked, and probably for some people it is working, the opposite way, of bringing more of a sense of doom and a lack of faith, a lack of meaning.
Well, I think I don't want to speak for everybody. I think some people have despaired and grown terribly angry and bitter. But I think for many, many other people, the experience of this enormous loss, a quarter of a million gay men in the last 10 years in a small community, has deepened one's sense of the fact that we're all mortal. And of course now 40 to 50% of gay men who are alive are also HIV positive. They also have a very deep sense of their mortality. And there's nothing like contemplating the last things to force you to contemplate what really matters in your life. And I think love and commitment are the things that matter in our friends and our relationships. And I think that's a deep shift. Gay people have always been, I think this is ironic, we've always been very spiritual and religious. I think we've always been disproportionately represented in the churches, in the priesthood, among religious. It's part of our otherness, I think, in some respects. And so, but go to the quilt. I mean, the quilt, I don't know whether anybody, you know, people listening have been there, but to me, it's like this enormous cathedral on the ground. It's a great spiritual monument, which was created as a spiritual monument because the churches weren't doing it for us. I think that it's one of the most spontaneous expressions of mass spirituality in our time.
You left your position editing the New Republic at the same time that you publicly revealed that you were HIV positive, and I'm wondering how your health is.
It's great.
Good.
I'm glad to say. I like to say less hair, more T-cells. I've got a new attitude about balding. It's like, okay, that's okay. As long as I'm a year older, I don't care. Yes, I'm on the new combination drugs, and they are not easy to take, to be honest. I think a lot of people are experiencing quite nasty side effects. You're very exhausted a lot of the time, and you have serious gastrointestinal problems and nausea and so on. But the underlying reality is that the virus in many people's body has been really strictly controlled. They can't detect it in my blood anymore, which is a great feeling. It's also very confusing because you spend several years, as I did, really bracing yourself for the worst and structuring your life around that. And then you get this reprieve. And it's both liberating, but also a little disorienting. And it's not happening for everybody. But I certainly, you know, find that I've never felt more grateful for health and for living each day. And since I've left, I've also sort of gotten more of a life, you know, in a way that I'm very grateful for.
Do you go through mood swings and thinking about how treatable AIDS ultimately will be and whether, you know, you're in a temporary remission or in a permanent state of better health?
Yes, you do. It's a total roller coaster. And recently, one of my first boyfriends recently got extremely sick and is close to death and almost certainly will die. And he's only 3 years older than me, and I realize that, you know, it's still here. I think you learn, at least what I've tried to learn, is not to hope for success or failure, not to hope for longevity or even not longevity, but to live in the knowledge that everything is uncertain and everything is fragile, and therefore you live with a certain as much integrity as you can day by day. And I think that goes for people who are not HIV positive too. I think confronting difficult illnesses is only different in degree, not in kind, than people who are healthy. I mean, we're all going to die. And the question is, at what level of our own consciousness have we come to terms with that? And I think that one thing having this does is keep that very much in your mind. And am I doing today what I want to do? Am I saying something that I believe in? Will this be something I'm proud of? And I think, frankly, I wish that I hadn't had to be HIV positive to have that better understanding. And of course, sometimes it disappears. But that's the irony of these situations.
Andrew Sullivan's new book is called Same-Sex Marriage, Pro and Con, A Reader. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Andrew Sullivan, the editor of the new book Same-Sex Marriage, Pro and Con, A Reader. Sullivan is the former editor of The New Republic. When he took over in 1991 at the age of 28, he was the youngest editor in the magazine's history. He was also the first openly gay editor of a national magazine that wasn't a gay magazine. He resigned from his position at The New Republic last year. At about the same time, he publicly revealed he was HIV positive. When you left The New Republic, you also left a life that was ruled by constant deadlines.
Yes, and
so now you have a life which you didn't have in that respect as editor of The New Republic. And when you leave that sense of like, well, my life right now is based on meeting the next deadline, there's a whole area of choice that's eliminated from your life. You don't have to choose what to do with the next hour or the next 2 hours. You know what you're doing with it. You're meeting your next deadline.
Yes.
Are you confronted with choices that have been difficult to make lately about what to do with the time in your life?
Yes. And frankly, I think also late last year, I actually sort of became rather depressed at the sense of anticlimax when I really found out that I was going to be fine and have years ahead of me. And really suffered about a month of lethargy and inexplicable depression. Choice is hard. What I think that we forget sometimes we cram our lives with these immediate deadlines and so on and busyness because we don't want to confront reality. We don't want to confront the big things. But spending time with one's friends and also different deadlines. I'm writing another book. This book. Took a certain amount of work, writing occasional pieces. Those things are still there. I'm just trying to be careful not to fill my life again with clutter to stop thinking the big things. You know, one of the weird things about being an editor in the news business at all is that part of our job is to reflect the world, you know, is to edit and to filter what's going on. But we become so bound up in the actual practical mechanical exigencies of day-to-day media production that we forget what living is.
When you're editing a magazine, you have to keep up with everything.
Yeah.
Not necessarily because you're writing about everything, but you're publishing about everything.
Yes.
And you need to, you just need to know.
I can't tell you how relieved I am.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Are you still, are you devouring newspapers every day?
You know, there are certain stories that I know in the past, you know, if there was a story about, you know, maybe a welfare reform project in Wisconsin that I would read diligently because I had to. Now, although I'm interested in many different things, it is so great to get up in the morning and think, you know, I don't think I'm going to read the paper today. Or to just read those stories that you're interested in, or to live basically like a normal person again. It is such a relief to... I have almost given up reading magazines, for example. I read books now. And I read for pleasure. And for so long I read, you know, to cram it all for professional purposes. And I remember why I loved politics and loved reading journalism and loved reading in the first place. It becomes this great new pleasure because it's part of your personal life, not your professional.
By leaving the magazine, you've lost power in the sense of, you know, power is mm-hmm. having editorial power. And you mm-hmm. also had certain power over other people's lives. I mean, you know, as supervising a staff and deciding what gets published and what doesn't. Do you miss any of that power? And do you miss having responsibility for other people, their lives and work?
No, it's the one thing that I found most uncomfortable in my job. I really found it difficult to feel responsible for other people's lives. Maybe I was too young, or maybe just I think it's too terrifying a prospect. I miss the power to put something on the agenda in quite the way I was able to at that magazine, or to really to shake things up a little bit in a certain debate. That's a huge thrill, because I love the clash of ideas, and I love the fact that at that magazine one was able to engage in that with almost greater freedom than anywhere else. But the responsibility for other human beings is such a difficult thing, and I felt it very deeply, and I found it extremely relieving to be free of that. Maybe that sounds as if I'm being irresponsible, but it isn't. I think it's just an awareness of how difficult that is, and managing people is very difficult, especially managing very creative, passionate, willful individuals.
You were telling us before about this month-long depression you sank into when you thought about the amount of time you had and the choices that you could make, worrying about whether you were spending the time right. What snapped you out of the depression?
I think I realized that part of it was guilt, that I had survived when my closest friend had not, that I came to understand that a lot of the depression was because of I'd internalized a lot of the grief that other people had felt and felt responsible for some of it. And I think that it just took me to confront that for the first time. I don't think I had confronted it until I had left the magazine, until I had confronted my own survival fully, to realize how guilty I felt about living when they had died. And that somehow confronting that made me realize, of course, they would not be at all sad to see me go on, and in fact I should go on more positively than before. But I don't know whether all of us who are surviving this plague feel the same way. I think we all have different moods and feelings about it, but I never even recognized it as guilt until I really thought deeply about it. But I think it lifted somehow, and I prayed a lot, and work also has always helped me get through those things.
If you don't mind my asking, what do you do when you pray? I mean, what does prayer mean to you? Are you asking for something? Do you feel like you're talking directly to God, or is it just a kind of discipline, like a meditation?
It's mostly silence, I think. It's mostly taking time to be composed and to try and listen to God. And to try and ask at some level for understanding of how to go forward. Sometimes it happens at Mass. Sometimes it happens at home. I have a little space at home, which I've carved out of my apartment to sit and do this. And sometimes it happens when you're riding your bike, or it's not necessarily completely... you're not necessarily motionless. I think it's letting your mind and soul be closer to God. You know, my favorite, one of the things that got me through the actual moment of finding out I was positive was the little stories in the Gospels about Jesus meeting Martha and Mary, and Martha running around when he arrives and fixing everything, and Mary sitting down and being with him, and Martha finally getting exasperated and saying to Jesus, look, I've got all this stuff to do. Tell Mary to come help me. And Jesus says, Martha, Martha, you fret and anxious about so many things. Mary has chosen the better path. Don't take it away from her. And all Mary was doing and was being with him. And I think being with God, which is what Emmanuel, it's what Jesus was about, that incarnation, being with God, or trying to be with God, is what prayer is for me. And of course, it's very, very hard. And I think in some ways, during the crisis times of my seroconversion, I was closer than I've ever been since. But I try and remember that, and I try and remember that presence and be in it, because it's not ultimately, I think, it's not ultimately about reaching out for something. It's about letting something reach you. It's not an active thing so much as a passive thing. There's an enormous amount of love in the world. The difficult thing is not loving or understanding. It is It is allowing oneself to be loved, allowing oneself to experience God's presence, which we throw up so many barriers to stop it happening because we are so frightened of that particular moment of intimacy.
Andrew Sullivan, I really want to thank you for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Andrew Sullivan edited the new book, Same-Sex Marriage, Pro and Con, A Reader.